How They Broke Britain, written and read by me, James O'Brien. This book is dedicated to the memory of James Jim O'Brien, journalist, 1939 to 2012. As long as the general population is passive, apathetic, diverted to consumerism or hatred of the vulnerable, then the powerful can do as they please, and those who survive will be left to contemplate the outcome. Noam Chomsky. Introduction. You can't actually boil a frog to death by popping it into a pot of cold water, placing it on a stove, and slowly turning up the temperature. When the heat becomes uncomfortable, the frog will hop out. Thermoregulation, evolution, and the fact that frogs are famously good at hopping will see to that. Boiling a frog remains a popular analogy because it conveys simply and effectively something that we know to be true. We often don't notice big changes if they happen in gradual stages, sometimes so gradually that we struggle even to notice the process until it is finished and the corruption complete. We wake up years later and reflect incredulously upon how things used to be, and then we wonder how such profound and unwelcome changes could have unfolded in plain sight. We know that we would never have accepted the new status quo if it had been offered to us at the outset, clear and complete. For while we recognise that the old status quo was imperfect and often horribly flawed, we still can't quite believe how far we have drifted from it and how measurably better things used to be. This is a story of slowly boiled water from which an entire country failed to escape. It is a tale of loss and betrayal, of unbridled arrogance and unchallenged ignorance, of personal impunity, warped ideology, and political incompetence. It is too early to say where the story will end, and impossible to pinpoint precisely where it began. But nevertheless, it is essential to identify the people and organisations which, sometimes by accident and sometimes quite deliberately, set the United Kingdom on a course of unnecessary domestic decline and international diminishment. Almost all of them remained in positions of power and prominence long after the damage they had done became clear to see. Many have since prospered, both professionally and privately, as the problems and tribulations they blithely ushered in took hold. None of them has ever offered the rest of us a single syllable of contrition or apology. It seems unlikely that they ever will. Worse, by the middle of 2023, it was becoming clear that the supporters of austerity, Brexit, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and sundry other disasters were determined to blame the consequences of their own epic errors on precisely the individuals and institutions that had spent years warning and explaining what those consequences would be. This last is a project that could only be contemplated, let alone completed, in a country already in complete thrall to the lies, prejudices, and manipulations of what would once have been referred to as the ruling class. This book, then, is a charge sheet, a compendium of poor behaviour and bad actors. More importantly, it is also an attempt to record and explain the creation of an ecosystem in which dishonesty could flourish and facts wither, where ordinary people, divorced from but entirely subjugated to the levers of power and influence, were fed an almost unleavened diet of deceit, division, and distraction. We will see that what has happened to the UK over the last few decades, notably since 2010, especially since 2016, and quite spectacularly since 2019, is as unforgivable as it is immense. Yet because those levers of power and influence are controlled by a comparatively tiny number of people in three easily identifiable and avowedly right-wing sections of public life, the media, politics, and wealth, the sheer abnormality of the national situation is rarely noted. We have become so conditioned by the parameters of the ecosystem we inhabit that we rarely notice how completely ridiculous our political reality and our country has become. The proof is everywhere, careering ridiculously from the seemingly silly to the deadly serious. From tomatoes being rationed in British supermarkets to government-inflicted economic catastrophe, what was once unthinkable has become almost unremarkable. Senior politicians, their advisers, and their cronies routinely remain in post after being found guilty of egregious behaviour. When they are found to have broken rules, they join forces to attack the rules. Strikes routinely cripple every corner of the public sector, most notably in the NHS, where patient satisfaction has plummeted while waiting lists grow exponentially. For the first time in living memory, children are less likely to own property than their parents. From pubs to pharmacies, businesses are closing every day as costs rise and vacancies go unfilled, while members of the government exhort us to celebrate the abolition of our own freedom of movement. Water companies, monopolistic beneficiaries of privatisation, deliver bumper bonuses to executives and shareholders while pumping record-breaking amounts of raw sewage into our waterways. In the first 9 months of 2022, 235 Crown Court trials were put off on the day they were due to start because there was no prosecutor available. By the end of the year, the total backlog of serious crime cases breached the 60,000 mark, while in magistrates' courts, the figure was over 340,000. The pain caused to individuals and families seeking justice is immeasurable. The generation of politicians and pundits that promised to take back control of our borders and immolate unspecified red tape has instead delivered epic delays and miles-long tailbacks at our ports, while making trade in goods with our nearest neighbours unfeasibly and unprecedentedly complicated. The trade deals, announced by the same politicians and cheered by the same pundits as a corrective to this unnecessary damage, have instead put our own farmers at a disadvantage against foreign competitors. In April 2023, 700,000 households missed their rent or mortgage payments. And for the people persuaded by decades of racist propaganda served up by supposedly respectable media that the country's problems were caused by a surfeit of foreign arrivals, the overall immigration numbers are higher than ever. Yet, confusingly, the European workers who once helped sustain now struggling sectors such as health and hospitality were stopped from coming and started to quit these shores in their droves. Everywhere, the sense of crisis is exacerbated by spiralling food and energy prices, plummeting wages, and crumbling public services. And yet successive Conservative administrations presiding over all of this persist in the demonisation of refugees, meaningless anti-woke rhetoric and bogus culture wars. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, told a meeting at her party conference in 2022, "I would love to have a front page of the Telegraph with a plane taking off to Rwanda. That's my dream. It's my obsession." The passengers on the plane of her dreams would be asylum seekers and refugees with no prospect of return to the UK, even when their applications had been processed and their bona fide refugee status determined. The destination of her dreams was later described in grim terms by the former head of the British Army. Richard Lord Dannett visited Rwanda as Chief of the General Staff in 2009 and sits on the All-Party Parliamentary Group, APPG, on war crimes investigating the Rwandan genocide. He said, "I've been to Rwanda, and the shadow of the genocide there in the 1990s hangs over that country. It's ruled with a very firm hand by current President and former military commander Paul Kagame. It's got a pretty dark history, and it's not the sort of environment I would put people from Syria and elsewhere in the world into." Braverman's dream still burned bright after she was made aware of evidence from the United Nations Refugee Agency, dating from 2018, that a group of Congolese refugees was shot dead by police during protests over cuts to food rations. And yet, according to Braverman, it is the people crossing the channel in so-called small boats who possess values that are at odds with our country. She is yet to provide any evidence of this claim or clarify precisely what values she and the rest of Rishi Sunak's government feel they themselves represent. It seems unlikely to be the ones upheld by King Charles, who reportedly described the Rwanda plan as appalling. All of these commercial catastrophes, national tragedies, and rhetorical atrocities occur because we live in a country where commentators are now routinely proved spectacularly wrong by political and economic events without suffering any real censure, where politicians frequently say things that turn out to be demonstrably untrue without ever being reminded of their errors by supine or sycophantic journalists, and where Experts, whose previous analyses were horribly inaccurate, continue to pop up in broadcast studios and newspapers with their status undimmed. The challenge is to stop seeing every example of national self-sabotage and decay in isolation and recognize instead that they are all symptoms of the same lethal malaise. Without many of us properly noticing, the United Kingdom has become a country where, both for editors and commentators gifted influence by their plutocratic patrons and for the political figures they favour, there are now no rules. The formal and informal strictures and traditions that bind society together and which render stability and decency at least theoretically important have been almost completely eradicated. There are no consequences for appalling personal or political behaviour. There is no semblance of public morality. There is no longer any consensual threshold for career-ending conduct. Simple truth has become negotiable, and proven liars have flourished as never before. Citing all the evidence has proved a surprisingly tricky business because, bluntly, there is so much of it. It feels at times like a Russian doll of ridiculousness. Twist the head off one example of political or media malfeasance that previously would have been unthinkable but went entirely unpunished after 2019, and another one immediately appears. Think of one shameful episode, and a dozen arguably more pertinent cases will spring to mind. They crowd each other out, multiply, and merge until you are left staring stupefied at the unbelievable catalogue of calumny, corruption, and incompetence that has been visited upon the country. So this account can't be exhaustive. There are simply too many contenders for inclusion, and neither can they be ranked. It would be too subjective. If, for example, you lost a loved one to the appalling handling of care homes at the beginning of the COVID-19 outbreak, you will perhaps be most enraged by the fact that 10 Downing Street subsequently became the site of more fines for criminal breaches of the lockdown laws Boris Johnson introduced than any other address in the country. Or by the fact that the health secretary, who claimed to have thrown a protective ring around those care homes, Matthew Hancock, shortly afterwards tried to relaunch himself as a celebrity by accepting £320,000 to appear on a TV game show. Or by the memory of Johnson's most senior advisor, self-styled Brexit mastermind Dominic Cummings, looking down the barrel of a television camera and claiming that he had driven his family on a 60-mile round trip to a local beauty spot on his wife's birthday in obvious breach of lockdown laws to test his eyesight. If, however, you lost a loved one to the Hillsborough tragedy in 1989, you may be most disgusted by the decades-long efforts of one of Rupert Murdoch's newspapers to malign the memories of the dead. If you needed help from one of the food banks or warm banks that have proliferated in recent years, then you may be most enraged by politicians who, while mismanaging the economy, have fetishized the UK's growth and ignored the plight of its people. And if you simply want to live in a country where decency is valued and the government provides safety nets and support for the population, where, in other words, there is such a thing as society, you may reserve most concern for the proliferation of secretly funded lobby groups, masquerading as think tanks, that have infiltrated every level of public life, despite representing the interests of nobody except the anonymous tycoons and vested interests who bankroll them. I will endeavour, then, to provide the most illustrative and arresting examples from an unapologetically personal perspective. The ones that, for me, most effectively describe the congregation of circumstances that allowed objectively ridiculous things to happen in a previously sensible society. Even dedicated followers of current affairs may well have struggled to keep up with the speed and size of change. Donald Trump's disgraced consigliere Steve Bannon, an exemplar of the far right who, despite overtly racist rhetoric, co-opted political power with the connivance of Rupert Murdoch's empire, vowed to flood the zone with shit in order to ensure that every scandal and shameful incident executed by his boss would soon be eclipsed by another. In the United Kingdom, there was no explicit plan to do the same, but such was the sheer volume of harm and damage done in a few years that the effect has been similar. I hope the experience of seeing the evidence assembled under one metaphorical roof will also be cathartic. It is for me. I apologise now for inevitable omissions. Consider first the abject idiocy of becoming the first population in history to vote to impose economic sanctions on itself. Worse, it was a vote built on promises that the country would somehow become richer as a consequence of leaving the European Union. There followed an inevitable erection of trade barriers between ourselves and our biggest trading partners. Consequently, in January 23, analysis by Bloomberg Economics found that Brexit was costing the UK £100 billion a year. The former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, stated in an interview that the UK is in the most difficult position of the major economies, full stop, and added it's been amplified by the separation from the European Union. The following month, Jonathan Haskell, a senior Bank of England official, published a study showing that since the 2016 referendum, the UK had suffered a loss of business investment amounting to £29 billion, or £1,000 per household. In March, Richard Hughes, the chairman of the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, an organisation set up in 2010 by the Conservative Chancellor George Osborne to detach official economic forecasts from government and provide independent advice on whether declared policies are likely to meet official targets, said leaving the EU had made an impact on the economy on the magnitude of the COVID-19 pandemic, and reduced the UK's overall output by 4% compared to where it would have been had the UK remained in the EU. Of course, these men are not infallible, and at least some of these numbers are debatable, but the overall picture is one of genuine economic catastrophe for which the governing party bears obvious responsibility. Yet you would simply not know this from the massive bulk of media coverage, where, if it gets reported at all, it is swiftly dismissed as evidence of an international conspiracy to punish the UK. This is as dangerous as it is daft. For example, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, is often portrayed in British newspapers and by conservative politicians as some sort of malevolent and mysterious anti-British organisation dedicated to damaging our interests on the world stage. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who was business minister in Liz Truss's disastrous administration, once said that their forecasts aren't worth the paper they're written on. Many readers of some newspapers and possibly even some politicians would be surprised to learn that it is, in fact, a United Nations agency encompassing some 190 countries that is designed to promote international monetary cooperation, international trade, high employment, exchange rate stability, and sustainable economic growth. Regarded as the international lender of last resort, it also loans money to member states in fiscal peril. In 1976, for example, it made a loan available to the UK's Labour government of almost $4 million, at the time the largest ever requested. While no forecaster is infallible, just ask Michael Fish, it is abundantly clear that the IMF's calculations and predictions are both important and evidence-based. People like Rees-Mogg, whose willfully ignorant position is frequently echoed in the comment pages of right-wing newspapers, either don't understand or don't care that all budgeting depends upon forecasts. Forecasts are literally the tools with which economists and politicians forge policies, and while they are by definition imperfect, they are also obviously essential. Understand the ecosystem in which these people could break Britain, and you will understand why they now have little choice but to denigrate any outlet dedicated to describing reality. In April 2023, the IMF adjusted its forecast for the British economy upwards. In terms of growth in gross domestic product, GDP, it would still be the worst performing in the G7 group of developed nations, but not by as big a margin as it had forecast in January. In March, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, another intergovernmental organisation founded to stimulate economic progress and international trade, found that the UK would have the second worst performing economy in the whole of the G20. Only Russia, heavily sanctioned and at war in Ukraine, was forecast to perform worse. Frighteningly, the IMF actually had Russia performing better than the UK in the same period. Either way, the picture is obviously bleak, and the only way to pretend otherwise is to pretend that these organisations are somehow deliberately misrepresenting data to embarrass the United Kingdom. It is remarkable how much credence these paranoid fantasies, and that's being generous, are still given. The problem, once again, is that we have become so inured to the madness that we have lost much of our ability to recognise it. It would be foolish to imagine that every utterance and calculation from the IMF or the OECD or the OBR was perfect. But it would be much more foolish to believe that all three of them would willfully mislead. And yet huge swathes of the right-wing media political establishment, with the active connivance of the secretly funded so-called think tanks, would have us do precisely that. Julian Jessop, a fellow of the grand-sounding Institute of Economic Affairs, IEA, even spoke to the Daily Mail of the OECD's usual institutional bias against the UK because of Brexit. This ludicrous combination of faux patriotism and bogus victimhood is an essential constituent of the ecosystem in which Liz Truss could inflict epic economic damage on the country. It is also a particularly clear example of how think tank, politician, and newspaper can combine to apply a patina of plausibility to what is, to all intents and purposes, gibberish. Shortly before Truss's mercifully brief administration collapsed under the weight of economic reality, for example, her business secretary Rees-Mogg claimed that the IMF likes having a pop at the UK for its own particular reasons. When, in May and June respectively, the IMF and the OECD upgraded their forecasts for the UK economy, the idiocy of these jingoistic positions would be laid bare. Obviously, neither Jessop, Rees-Mogg, nor any of their fellow free market fetishists argued that the institutions were now suddenly acting out of irrational affection for the UK. Truss's disastrous policies, underpinned by her Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng's politically suicidal decision to exclude the OBR completely from his computations, cost the public purse an estimated £30 billion and were widely regarded as coming straight from the self-appointed economic experts at the IEA. Indeed, Truss spoke at more IEA events between 2010 and 2022 than any other politician. And in 2011 set up the Free Enterprise Group of Tory MPs, arguably the parliamentary wing of the IEA. The organisation's Director General, grandiose titles are de rigueur at the IEA, where pretty much everybody is head of something or other, Mark Littlewood, has described her as being generally engaged in the ideas, rather than just occasionally turning up to say a few warm words at a Christmas party. When she won the Tory leadership in September 2022, a stalwart of the Brexit think tank Tory media triangle called Tim Montgomery tweeted, "A massive moment for the IEA. They've been advocating these policies for years. They incubated Truss and Kwarteng during their early years as MPs. Britain is now their laboratory." Littlewood, apparently delighted with the analysis, responded with a smiling sunglasses face emoji. The very first experiment in that laboratory would crash the markets and see Britain brought to the brink of recession within days. It culminated in Kwarteng being jettisoned less than 6 weeks into the job and Truss resigning shortly after, having lost the confidence of almost all her MPs. There is, as we shall see, a grim symmetry to the fact that none of these experts suffer any professional setbacks when their ideas are comprehensively discredited. On the contrary, Jessop's opinions were still being widely sought and published in 2023, and Truss even sought to put Littlewood in the House of Lords. If forecasts from the likes of the OECD, OBR and IMF seek to plot the path ahead with all the obvious unpredictabilities, then the UK's Office for National Statistics, ONS, is concerned with mapping the road already travelled. Its export figures for October to December 2022 made grisly reading. Excluding precious metals, British exports were down 9% on the pre-pandemic average. Not that you would have been reading much about them in organs still clinging desperately to the carcass of Brexit. Ludicrous but widespread claims that the UK's more general plight was somehow a consequence of the pandemic and war in Ukraine fall apart when we learn that, for example, Italy and Japan enjoyed double-figure growth in exports during the same period. Analyses by the OBR and the Bank of England for the Financial Times showed that the UK's exports may be even weaker still, with the OBR predicting that the underperformance will continue for the next 2 years. Once again, it is Jacob Rees-Mogg who proves that it is possible to publicly and pompously poo-poo such forecasts if you don't like their content. He stated in 2022 that the record of the OBR, the UK fiscal watchdog, remember, set up by a Conservative Chancellor with the express aim of providing the most objective and independent advice available, hasn't been enormously good, adding that it is not the only organisation that is able to give forecasts. As with so many of the problems facing the UK in 2023 and beyond, this brand of delusional denialism and Pollyanna-ish determination to find experts to only say things that politicians and newspaper editors want to hear can be traced back to the Brexit referendum of 2016. The moral and intellectual compromises needed to sustain and disseminate campaign lies during the referendum created a cohort of Conservative politicians that would become increasingly detached from both observable reality and any semblance of public integrity. That they weren't expecting to win is well documented, but the lasting damage stems not from their victory, but from their inability to disown the deceptions that delivered it. The guiltiest men and women here are not, I would argue, the pantomime characters like Rees-Mogg, previously best known for fighting a by-election with his childhood nanny by his side, or the bigots and weirdos who swelled the ranks of the party's European Research Group, ERG, but the ones who were supposedly respectable or sensible. It was the co-chair of Vote Leave, Michael Gove, who said, "I think the people in this country have had enough of experts from organisations with acronyms saying that they know what is best and getting it consistently wrong." After securing victory in the referendum and prompting David Cameron's resignation as Prime Minister in 2016, Gove backed his Vote Leave co-chair Boris Johnson's bid to become PM before withdrawing his support, saying, "I came in the last few days, reluctantly and firmly, to the conclusion that while Boris has great attributes, he was not capable of uniting that team and leading the party and the country in the way that I would have hoped." Johnson pulled out of the contest and Gove launched his own leadership campaign. He was eliminated from the contest after securing 14.6% of the vote in the first ballot of Conservative MPs and 14% in the second. Theresa May triumphed after the withdrawal of her only remaining rival, Andrea Leadsom, but May was then effectively deposed by her former Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, in 2019. At this point, Gove somehow overcame his reservations about Johnson to serve in his government as, variously, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Cabinet Office Minister, Secretary of State for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, and Minister for Intergovernmental Relations. He was dismissed by Johnson in July 2022, after telling the soon-to-resign Prime Minister to resign. Gove, Johnson, Jessop, Rees-Mogg, Truss and Littlewood, these are the type of people who flourished most in post-Brexit Britain, even as everything they touched began to crumble. They sustained support, even in two cases after leaving Downing Street in disgrace, by constantly denying reality, inventing persecution, shifting blame and trying to rewrite history. I hope that this book will play a small part in preventing them from doing so. By the middle of 2023, many key players in this national tragedy had already embarked on the rewriting history element of this process with gusto. The alternative would have been to admit their role in the shaping of events that had, by any measure, gone horribly wrong. It is a simple concept to grasp, but the levels of dishonesty and disingenuousness required to actually pursue it are breathtaking. In April, former Daily Telegraph and Spectator editor Charles Moore's byline appeared in the Telegraph beneath the headline, "Why is the left in the driving seat of Tory government after 13 years of Tory rule?" It is hard to imagine a more perfect example of self-exculpatory tribal delusion, and it is hard to imagine a more perfect example of the sort of characters that flourish in the ecosystem under scrutiny here than Moore. Inevitably, there is an opaquely funded think tank on his CV. He is a former chairman of Policy Exchange, judged by Transparify, an initiative that provides a global rating of the financial transparency of major think tanks, as one of the three least transparent think tanks in the UK. His cronyism credentials are similarly impeccable. In 2020, he was gifted a seat in the House of Lords by former Daily Telegraph columnist and Spectator editor Boris Johnson. In 2010, Moore was fined for not paying his television licence fee in protest against the lewd behaviour of Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand on BBC Radio 2. 10 years later, he was reportedly Boris Johnson's first choice for the chairmanship of the same BBC. It was reported that he demanded a £280,000 salary to take the role, three times the pay of the previous incumbent. But he shortly ruled himself out for family reasons after renewed attention was paid to a 1992 Spectator article in which he wrote, "The Korean sets up the grocery store which the black then robs. That is the caricature which modern America recognises. Why has this happened then? One explanation, made endlessly in conversation and hardly ever in print, is that there really is something different about blacks, or at least about black men, or at least about young black men." This is a remarkable admission of the sort of conversations that occur endlessly in Moore's milieu. Talking about people in the UK and US, he went on to argue that they detect in black youths an aggression and defiance and indifference to normal moral and social constraints which frighten them. If it is true, as it surely is, that some races, the Jews are the obvious example, are highly enterprising and talented, it may also be true that some are the opposite. Moore's disgust at indifference to normal moral and social constraints had apparently been somewhat diluted by November 2021, when he hosted a dinner at London's private members' club, the Garrick. There, guests, including Boris Johnson, discussed how the career of Moore's close friend, former Environment Secretary Owen Paterson, might be saved. Paterson was in trouble after a two-year investigation by the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, Catherine Stone, found he had committed an egregious breach of lobbying rules on behalf of two companies that were paying him more than £100,000 per annum. Paterson, a prominent Brexiter who had segued effortlessly from arguing that only a madman would actually leave the market in 2014 to championing a no-deal departure from the EU in 2019, certainly had a protective ring thrown around him. With the vocal support of the leader of the House of Commons, Jacob Rees-Mogg, former Cabinet Minister Andrea Leadsom introduced an amendment calling not only for Paterson to be spared the 30-day suspension imposed by the Commissioner, but also for a new Conservative-dominated committee to draw up an entirely new set of rules regarding parliamentary standards. Having seen one of their own fall foul of the rulebook, in other words, they determined to tear it up and write a new one. It is important to note the levels of entitlement and presumptions of impunity at play here. Brexiters all, Rees-Mogg had recently misled the late Queen about the unlawful prorogation of Parliament. Leadsom's ill-fated bid to become Prime Minister had been derailed partly by questions about her CV and her tax affairs, while Johnson had already weathered at least three storms that could conceivably have ended his premiership. It is hardly surprising, then, that they thought they could get away with such an obvious and self-serving assault on parliamentary standards. What followed constitutes a very rare example of the establishment cabal failing to get their own way. For while the amendment passed, thanks to a three-line whip and Johnson's enormous majority, the backlash was so furious that the plan was abandoned within 24 hours and Paterson resigned his seat on the 5th of November. Rees-Mogg, who had previously implied that the 72 people who died in the Grenfell Tower tragedy in June 2017 perished because they lacked common sense, later claimed that his judgment had been clouded by sympathy for Paterson, whose wife Rose had died the previous year. Paterson himself later sought to blame her suicide on stresses brought on by the investigation into his own egregious breaches of parliamentary standards. Moore, a self-appointed arbiter of public morality who quit the Church of England in protest at the ordination of women priests, and once wrote regarding gay marriage, "I wonder if the law will eventually be changed to allow one to marry one's dog," had begun the whole sorry process with another Daily Telegraph article headlined, "The Hounding of Owen Paterson Sets a Dangerous Precedent in Parliament." Despite the scale of this humiliation, none of Paterson's champions suffered the slightest personal or professional setback as a consequence of their conduct. Many Fleet Street watchers, including this one, wondered whether the Daily Mail's uncharacteristically strong line on the indefensibility of Paterson's position and the shameful Moore-Johnson-Rees-Mogg rescue attempt might have hastened the departure of Geordie Gregg from the editor's office of the Mail. A quiet opponent of Brexit, Gregg had steered the paper past the Sun to become the biggest seller in the UK, but he was unexpectedly dismissed by the owner, Jonathan Viscount Harmsworth, just 12 days after Paterson's resignation. His replacement was Ted Verity, a protege of Paul Dacre, the paper's previous editor. With unmistakable echoes of Charles Moore's preferment, Boris Johnson had sought to put Dacre both in the House of Lords and in charge of the broadcasting regulator, Ofcom. The Mail's position as an unquestioning cheerleader of Boris Johnson was swiftly restored. Less than a year later, it reported Johnson's removal from office by his own colleagues with a lachrymose front-page headline, "What have they done?" Meanwhile, that chairmanship of the BBC from which Charles Moore ruled himself out, perhaps to spend more time conversing endlessly about the fundamental differences of blacks, went instead to Johnson's next favoured candidate, Richard Sharp. In November 2020, ITV's political editor, Robert Peston, reported that would-be applicants were being told by ministers, "Don't waste your time applying, the PM has made up his mind, it will be Richard Sharp." A deep-pocketed donor to the Tory party, more than £400,000 over a 20-year period, Sharp is a former director of the Centre for Policy Studies, judged by Transparify to be one of the four least transparent think tanks in the UK, and one of a handful that refuse to reveal even the identities of their donors. Giving evidence to the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, DCMS, of MPs in January 2021, Sharp said that he was considered to be a Brexiteer and accepted that he suffered from confirmation bias on the issue. He was also Rishi Sunak's boss at the merchant bank Goldman Sachs and, for reasons that remain unclear, was working at Downing Street as an unpaid advisor to his former underling during the COVID-19 crisis. It was during this period that he made his interest in the BBC chairmanship known to both Sunak and Johnson, for whom he had also worked as an advisor when Johnson was Mayor of London. A busy man. In September 2020, Sharp dined with a wealthy Canadian businessman called Sam Blythe, a distant cousin of Boris Johnson, who offered to alleviate Johnson's notoriously precarious financial situation. For, despite once describing the £250,000 per annum he received for writing a weekly Daily Telegraph column as chicken feed, by the time Johnson became Prime Minister, an expensive divorce and child support payments for a variety of progeny born both inside and outside his marriages had left him short of ready cash. By way of example, in April 2021, it emerged that Johnson and his then-fiancée Carrie Simmons had overseen a redecoration of their Downing Street apartments that had reportedly cost up to £200,000 and featured £840 a roll wallpaper. This, despite the fact that the Prime Minister receives an annual grant of just £30,000 a year to spend on his or her home. Dominic Cummings would later claim that his former boss's plans to have donors secretly pay for the renovation were unethical, foolish, possibly illegal, and almost certainly broke the rules on proper disclosure of political donations if conducted in the way he intended. And while Johnson was cleared of breaking the ministerial code by his second ethics advisor, Christopher Lord Gyte, the Electoral Commission ruled in December 2021 that the Conservative Party had broken electoral laws by using funds gifted by another rich party donor, David Lord Brownlow, to pay for the redecoration without properly declaring the money. The following month, it emerged that Johnson, whose defence hinged upon the claim that he had no idea where the money was coming from, had failed to inform Gyte of a WhatsApp exchange with Brownlow in November 2020. A furious Gyte published the conversation in full. It made for remarkable reading. "I am afraid parts of our flat are still a bit of a tip and I'm keen to allow Lulu Little to get on with it. Can I possibly ask her to get in touch with you for approvals? Many thanks and all best, Boris. P.S. I'm on the Great Exhibition plan. We'll revert." Lulu Little is the high society interior decorator retained by Simmons. Her clientele includes Mick Jagger, and her presence at the birthday party in June 2020 that led to both Johnson and Sunak being fined for breaking their own lockdown laws rather undermined their defence that it was a work event. The Great Exhibition refers to a pet project of Brownlow's that would emulate the 1851 cultural and commercial jamboree conceived by Prince Albert. Downing Street insisted that, despite Johnson's promise, Brownlow's plan was not taken forward. Nevertheless, 2 months after the text exchange, the official diary of Johnson's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, described a meeting with Royal Albert Hall and Lord Brownlow to discuss plans for Great Exhibition 2.0. Brownlow, at least, seemed pleased, replying, "Afternoon, Prime Minister. I hope you're both well. Sorry for the delay. I was out for a walk and didn't have my work phone with me. Of course, get Lulu to call me and we'll get it sorted ASAP. Thanks for thinking about GE2. Best wishes, David." Later adding, I should have said, as the trust isn't set up yet, will be in January, approval is a doddle, as it's only me, and I know where the pounds will come from. So as soon as Lulu calls, we can crack on. David. Johnson issued a humble and sincere apology to Geit, who would eventually resign in June 2022, reportedly telling a confidant that he was sick of being lied to for his failure to disclose the exchange. Johnson claimed to have no memory of it, and also that he had been unable to retrieve the messages because he had adopted a new phone number. The second claim is certainly true. He was compelled to abandon his old number after the gossip website PopBitch revealed in April 2021 that it had been on public view for 15 years after being printed at the bottom of a press release from a think tank. Geit was unimpressed, replying, "Had I been aware of the missing exchange, I would have had further questions and drawn attention to it in my report. More crucially, I doubt whether I would have concluded without qualification what is set out in paragraph 33 of my report that, at the point when the Prime Minister became aware, he took steps to make the relevant declaration and to seek advice." It was in the midst of this episode of unseemly scrounging, disappearing WhatsApps and prime ministerial impecuniousness that Sam Blyth told Richard Sharp he was keen to guarantee a loan for his distant cousin. Some truly first-class journalism from Gabriel Pogrand and Harry York of the Sunday Times in January 2023 revealed that Sharp had introduced Blyth to the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, and that the loan arrangement was finalised in December 2020 before the funds were released the following February. It is still not clear where the £800,000 loan came from, only that Blyth acted as guarantor. Sharp, however, neglected to mention any of this during his application to become chairman of the BBC, despite the application rules stating you cannot be considered for a public appointment if you fail to declare any conflict of interest. Candidates are also required to declare anything that could later undermine confidence in the appointment. Without the work of Pogrand and York, it is unlikely that any of this would have come to light. Sharp, a crony of both Johnson and Sunak, who had the audacity to pronounce on the liberal bias of the corporation he chaired, would still be in post. Precedent-challenging behaviour, such as sitting on the panel that appointed a new chief executive of BBC News, would have presumably continued. Instead, in April 2023, he announced his resignation after an investigation by the Office of the UK Commissioner of Public Appointments concluded he had broken the rules by failing to declare his link to Johnson's loan, creating a potential perceived conflict of interest. Even here, though, the murkiness at the heart of the British Conservative establishment is still not fully understood. The investigation into Richard Sharp's appointment was originally to have been conducted by the actual Commissioner for Public Appointments, William Shawcross, who was appointed in October 2021. An avowed Brexiter and former journalist, Shawcross is the father of Eleanor Shawcross, who became head of 10 Downing Street's policy unit after donating £20,000 to Rishi Sunak's leadership campaign. He is also a former director of the Henry Jackson Society, a neoconservative think tank described by its co-founder Matthew Jameson as having become a far-right, deeply anti-Muslim propaganda outfit used to smear other cultures, religions and ethnic groups. Between 2012 and 2018, Shawcross was chair of the Charity Commission for England and Wales and oversaw guidance, later withdrawn, that said charities should only campaign in the EU referendum in exceptional circumstances. A week after telling the Shadow Culture Secretary, Lucy Powell, that he would review Sharp's appointment to assure myself and the public that the process was run in compliance with the rules, Shawcross was forced to recuse himself after admitting that he had met Sharp on previous occasions. Perhaps he had forgotten. The report was compiled instead by Adam Heppenstall, KC, and confirmed Peston's scoop that the panel running the independent recruitment process for the job was informed that Sharp was the only candidate that the government would support. That four-person panel, incidentally, included Catherine Baxendale, who was shortlisted to be a Tory parliamentary candidate in 2017 and gave £50,000 to the party when David Cameron was Prime Minister, and Blondell Clough, whose husband Algie owned The Spectator from 1980 until 1985 and remained as chairman until the end of 2004. The five editors he worked with there included Charles Moore and Boris Johnson. The current chairman is the former BBC presenter and Rupert Murdoch editor, Andrew Neil. If you're finding the labyrinthine links, social connections, and rampant cronyism hard to follow, Spare a thought for the tiny handful of British journalists minded to actually understand what goes on in the corridors of power and influence. You can surely see now what I mean about Russian dolls. What began a few pages ago as a passing reference to delusional denial in one newspaper headline atop one article by Charles Moore led inexorably to half a dozen other examples of just how far we've fallen and just who bears responsibility for it. We will examine some of these examples in more detail later, but many of the recurring themes and characters are already plain to see. There is racism, albeit of the patrician variety still espoused in the pages of Andrew Neil's Spectator. There is exceptionalism, because just as Brexiters couldn't believe that Britain might somehow be denied special treatment by the EU, so they can't understand why one of their own might be expected to abide by the rules that everybody else is required to follow. There is pathetic, bogus victimhood, because just as the IMF supposedly punishes the UK for Brexit, so Moore and co. were arguing throughout that Pattison's treatment was somehow a punishment for his Brexit support, as opposed to a consequence of his obvious misconduct. There is arrogance, obviously, and there is ignorance aplenty, but what is perhaps most telling about the Pattison episode is the fact that, for an unconscionably long time, it marked pretty much the only occasion when the liars, cheats and incompetents did not emerge triumphant. This was almost certainly down to the fact that the editorship of the Daily Mail was, briefly, in the hands of a principled man. In the same month that Moore's article appeared, an obscure academic called Matthew Goodwin embarked upon an even more ridiculous flight of fancy that somehow filled an entire book. Previously Nigel Farage's amanuensis, Goodwin's laughable thesis is that the real brokers of power in Brexit Britain are not the people in control of government and most of the media, but, inter alia, the footballer turned broadcaster Gary Lineker, the broadcaster and entrepreneur Carol Vorderman, and, well, me. The chief qualification for inclusion in this new elite seemed to be a rejection of racist rhetoric, a willingness to criticise successive Conservative governments for presiding over a period of unprecedented decline, and the possession of a decent following on Twitter. Despite his obvious absurdity, Goodwin received an extraordinary amount of coverage in right-wing newspapers. That the editors of The Sun and The Telegraph would embrace this nonsense is perhaps not very surprising, but it seemed a strange fit for The Times, until you remembered that the newish editor, Tony Gallagher, had previously occupied the editor's chair at both The Sun and The Daily Telegraph, as well as enjoying a stint as deputy editor of The Daily Mail. People such as Gallagher, who once stated, "My huge admiration for Paul Dacre is well known," seem to believe that it's not people like his past and present bosses, Rupert Murdoch, Viscount Rothermere, the Barclay family and Paul Dacre, that most effectively use the UK media to wield political influence in this country. It's Gary Lineker, Carol Vorderman and me. This is about desperation rather than coordination. Moore and Goodwin did not cook up their ludicrous theses together, and they are just two among an army of offenders. Alistair Heath, the current editor of the Sunday Telegraph, deserves some sort of prize. "This was the best budget I have ever heard a Chancellor deliver by a massive margin," he wrote on the front page of the Daily Telegraph the morning after Kwasi Kwarteng announced his disastrous mini-budget. He was, I suppose, accidentally accurate when he called it a moment in history that will radically transform Britain. Heath had previously insisted that our declinist Remainer class has outdone itself, demonising and dismissing Liz Truss and working itself up into a frenzy of self-righteous rage and indignation at the supposed incompetence of her new government. Like the politicians they protect, these people, often occupying previously august positions in the highest echelons of the British newspaper industry, face no consequences for being frequently and spectacularly wrong. On the contrary, they lurch from one unhinged diatribe to the next with no discernible pause for reflection. By the end of April 2023, for example, Heath was explaining that Britain is being impoverished by a Remainer mind virus, and in August that the fury of the silent majority is driving a global right-wing counter-revolution. They are not fringe outliers or amusing contrarians hired for their willingness to challenge mainstream journalism. They are the mainstream, and they have all now arrived, through opportunism and necessity, at a place where they can just about persuade themselves that the abject failure of the policies and politicians they favoured for years must somehow be the fault of other factors. They blame it instead on a new elite or left-wing conservative governments or a Remainer mind virus. No matter how flimsy the argument or how objectively pathetic the premise, politics and the media remain full of people still similarly unable to accept their role in what has happened. It is literally impossible to exaggerate the depths they will plumb to pass the buck. Consider Elizabeth Truss herself. Just as this attempt to deflect and deny their own obvious responsibility for countless disasters was being ramped up to ludicrous levels by British newspapers, the politician who perhaps best embodies the whole sorry mess popped up in America to claim that her catastrophic 49-day tenure as Prime Minister was somehow the responsibility of everyone, indeed anyone, but her. We didn't just face coordinated resistance from inside the Conservative Party or even inside the British corporate establishment. We faced it from the IMF and even from President Biden, she said in a speech to the Heritage Foundation, inevitably another secretly funded policy-influencing right-wing think tank. The sad truth is, what I think we've seen over the past few years is a new kind of economic model taking hold in our countries, one that's focused on redistributionism, on stagnation, and on the imbuing of woke culture into our businesses. I call these people the anti-growth movement. Again, it is important to pause and absorb the sheer scale of the absurdity being promulgated here. Liz Truss became a minister in 2012, when David Cameron was Prime Minister. 2 years later, she replaced Owen Paterson as Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. Subsequently, and under a total of 3 Tory Prime Ministers, she has served as Justice Secretary, Lord Chancellor, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, International Trade Secretary and Foreign Secretary. She had been, by any measure, an integral part of the UK government for over a decade, rising to one of the great offices of state before securing the keys to Downing Street itself. But throughout the entirety of her governmental career, a new kind of economic model had been taking over the country about which she had never previously said a single word. Let me show you even more of what I mean when I talk about this Russian doll of ridiculousness and the suffocating intertwining of right-wing media, politics and think tanks. For if Truss represents an apotheosis of incompetence being overpromoted, there are plenty of other case studies. Consider the post-Brexit careers of 2 more people to hold one of the 4 great offices of state at the pinnacle of British government, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab and Home Secretary Suella Braverman. As with Moore's article or Johnson's loan, you will see how recalling one example of their gross ineptitude or obvious unfitness for office immediately reminds us of another element or architect of our own unfolding tragedy, then another, and then another. And while it is tempting to hope that the complete abandonment of political integrity or competence ushered in by the elevations of Johnson and Truss to Prime Minister might have ended with their enforced departures, Raab and Braverman also remind us that this remains far too optimistic a position. So let's twist a Russian doll, in this case Dominic Raab's swift ascent from richly deserved obscurity to Foreign Secretary and Deputy Prime Minister, and see what we find. Trace this unlikely trajectory back to its beginning, and immediately David Davis appears. Davis was Raab's predecessor as Secretary of State and Chief Negotiator for leaving the European Union. It is worth remembering why. When Theresa May became Prime Minister after David Cameron's resignation in 2016, she faced what would prove to be an intractable problem: how to steer the country through the imminent negative impacts of the Brexit she had campaigned against but now had to deliver, while somehow appeasing the victorious colleagues and newspaper editors who refused to accept that there would be any negative impacts at all. The madness that flowed from this simple and obvious impossibility will also run through this book like Blackpool through a stick of rock. But for now, we are concerned with only one of its consequences. She had to appoint people to key positions whose Brexit credentials were impeccable, regardless of competence or calibre. Both Dominic Raab and David Davis prove this point perfectly. Like most self-styled staunch Eurosceptics, their grasp of what departure from the European Union would actually entail was at best delusional and at worst downright stupid. In a rare moment of honesty and acuity, Dominic Cummings, the former director of the Vote Leave campaign and another key architect of the UK's self-inflicted decline, described Davis as thick as mince, lazy as a toad, and vain as Narcissus. The accuracy of this accusation is hard to dispute, but in the ecosystem under scrutiny here, it would prove no obstacle to advancement. Quite the opposite. In May 2016, 1 month before the referendum secured Brexit, 2 months before May charged him with delivering it, and several years before either of them understood what might actually be possible, he tweeted, "The first calling point of the UK's negotiator immediately after Brexit will not be Brussels, it will be Berlin to strike a deal." The ignorance on display here is considerable. EU member states cannot conduct trade negotiations autonomously, and the notion that having rendered itself a third country, the UK would somehow enjoy favoured status is ambitious, to say the least. But by May 2016, it didn't matter. Despite being a prominent British politician, a former leadership contender and shadow Home Secretary, Davis displayed abject ignorance of quite simple but crucial concepts. As a harbinger of the epic absurdity that would follow, he simply stated what the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph and the whole Vote Leave machine wanted to be true without any reproach or consequence. People with a grasp of the facts were dismissed as Ramonas or tribunes of Project Fear, and the truth was simply and effectively subjugated. Most appallingly at this time, by permitting one of the most prominent members of the hard-right media establishment to masquerade as an impartial senior politics presenter, the BBC undermined much of its own ability to provide a sorely needed corrective. In February 2016, Andrew Neil, a former Rupert Murdoch editor and chairman of the pro-Brexit Spectator magazine, was presenting an edition of the BBC Daily Politics show in which Davis rehearsed his German car industry delusions while former Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett looked on incredulously. It is notable for two reasons. First, the way in which Neil treats Beckett's evidence and experience as a mere and equal counterbalance to Davis's ignorance and bluster. Second, the smugness and cronyism of Neil and Davis. Davis. "The day after Brexit happens, the chief executives of Volkswagen, BMW, Audi..." Neil. "You've missed out Mercedes." Davis. "And Mercedes. I know you've got one. Ha ha ha. Ha. You've got to know how to tease him." As Andrew Neil chuckles delightedly, Davis continues, "They will all be queuing up saying we've got to have access for our 16 billion market." Margaret Beckett's response is, in retrospect, chillingly prescient. You can see her briefly considering an uncharacteristic departure from basic politeness, and she often seems to struggle to find the appropriate words. Beckett, "I think it's pie in the sky, frankly. And I know David was Europe Minister at one time, but I have a bit of experience of European negotiations myself." Neil, "As Foreign Secretary." Beckett, "Over something like 10 or 11 years of intense negotiations, both on agriculture and on climate change. And I just think, if I can say so with, I hope, some modesty, I do quite pride myself on my negotiating skills and track record. Don't give me a brief like that. The risks are huge and the certainties are none." A year later, in July 2017, his hubristic arrogance was crystallised in photographic form when Davis, having accepted the brief so scathingly described by Beckett, sat down to begin negotiating the UK's withdrawal from the EU. A process likened to removing the eggs from a baked cake apparently presented no problems at all to this former SAS reservist. The now infamous picture shows him and two colleagues sitting opposite the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, and his team. The latter have piles of documents on the glass table in front of them. Davis, beaming at the camera, has none, not a single sheet. It's possible that, looking down, he would have seen only his own reflection gurning back at him. Oliver Robbins, the senior civil servant in Davis's box-fresh ministry, has a slim black notebook and a pen before him, but it's hard to imagine any image capturing more perfectly the ridiculousness not just of Davis, but of the entire UK government. And a year after that, in July 2018, Davis was gone, resigning his post after achieving nothing and understanding less. The forces of furious denialism that would shortly propel Boris Johnson into Downing Street were by now stirring in opposition to Theresa May's at least pragmatic plan for a UK-EU free trade area. And Davis, he of the noteless negotiations and mythical trips to Berlin to conclude impossible deals, opined that, "It seems to me we're giving too much away, too easily, and that's a dangerous strategy." Fellow Brexit minister Steve Baker, who would later start referring to himself as the hard man of Brexit, also resigned, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, chairman of the ERG, wrote in the Daily Telegraph, where else, that he would vote against May's proposal. It seemed unlikely that Davis's successor in the role, whoever that may be, could be less effective. Unlikely, but not, it soon transpired, impossible. A largely unnoticed housing minister with a brief and unspectacular legal career behind him, Dominic Raab's support for leaving the EU in the 2016 referendum was his only obvious qualification for promotion. May's mission to mitigate the inevitable negative impacts of Brexit was doomed by many factors, not least reality. But it was the necessity of appointing people who believed in the impossible that did her most damage. And it did not take Raab long to demonstrate his credentials. As with Davis, it is important to remember that Raab not only campaigned for Brexit, but also professed to have a better understanding of the facts than the experts adamant that we would not be able to enjoy the benefits of EU membership after ceasing to be EU members. And as with Davis, it is hard to decide what is most shocking: Raab's failure to understand the most basic precepts of his negotiating position, or the absolute absence of consequences this failure had. Consider the following comment made in November 2018, long after hauliers, couriers, customs agents and countless other professionals with long experience of importing and exporting goods between the UK and the rest of the EU had warned of the problems ahead. "I hadn't quite understood the full extent of this, but if you look at the UK and look at how we trade in goods, we are particularly reliant on the Dover-Calais crossing." This, of course, is akin to a recently appointed football manager revealing that he hadn't previously appreciated the importance of putting the ball over the opposition's goal line. An Institute for Government report had previously described Dover as a key artery for UK trade heading to continental Europe, with more than 2.5 million heavy goods vehicles passing through the port every year. It also described goods worth £119 billion passing through the port in 2015, representing around 17% of the UK's entire trade in goods by value. Yet Raab's incredible ignorance barely gives him pause. The combination of the Conservative Party's Brexit cultishness and the right-wing media's rejection of observable reality meant that Raab could disgrace himself like this on the grandest stage and suffer not one jot. Indeed, a week later, and 129 days after taking the job, Raab himself resigned from May's government, insisting that her plans to keep Northern Ireland attached to EU regulations after Brexit posed a very real threat.